Huff Daddy. This is The Outside Gate with Steve Hall on the L4 Media Network, where we talk US moto and anywhere the conversation goes. Joining me today is the 1994 and 1995 West Coast 125 Supercross champion and all-rounds 90s and 2000 superstar, Damon Huffman. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me on.
No worries, man. As always, I'm thrilled to have any of these guys on that I used to read about in magazines, you know. So it's good to meet your heroes, as they say. Sometimes they say don't meet your heroes, but I've found that in motocross that is definitely wrong. I'd say do meet your heroes in this sport. So yeah,
definitely a lot of good guys in motocross. You know, it's a brutal sport, and you know, a lot of classy old moto dudes still hanging around, you know, like myself.
Yeah, absolutely, man. What have you been up to just lately? So I know you get right into mountain biking. I've watched a couple of your mountain bike videos, and you've got a YouTube channel for mountain bike videos and stuff.
I do. Yeah, I do that purely for fun. It's fun to do. I do a lot of the videos with my two boys. And I do, I try to do just enough to still get a little love from like Intense Bicycles or Fast House, and get some free stuff here and there. But I love mountain biking. When I get done mountain biking, I feel really good, you know. But moto, I'm 48 now. So when I ride motocross, I come back and I'm like beat up, really beat up feeling.
Yeah. I know what you mean. I love cycling. Where I live, there's no good mountain biking. You know, it's where I live is it's very, very flat. So you need hills for mountain bikes. It's in the name, isn't it? Mountain bike. So I just road bike. But I know after a good ride on the pushy, as we call them. It just feels great, you know. I love that sort of exercise, that grind, and just being out in the wind and all that sort of thing. It's just, you know, it's not as good as moto, of course, but it's good in a different way, though, isn't it? Yeah, it's a strange thing to explain.
It is.
Hard to explain to people what that pedaling does for you if they're not into it, I guess. Yeah.
Yep, for sure. You know, my ankles and knees, you know, they've taken a beating. So that cycling motion, you know, I walk away and it feels like it helps. So
it does, man. I've got a dodgy ankle. Everyone that's ridden dirt bikes has got something dodgy in their legs or hips.
Absolutely.
And it helps heaps, man. It really, I think it keeps those ankles and knees and everything, you know, strong and loose and, Yes. It's good fun. Yeah. Cool, man. Cool. Hey, we might, you know, what we usually do and what the show's generally all about is about people's dirt biking lives. Mm-hmm. And so the first question, my go-to is, when did the bug bite, man? When did you first see a mini bike or ride one? You know, when did the bug bite you for dirt bikes?
Yeah. You know, I was either around four, turning five, around 5 years old, and I actually had a little 50. It was I think my first bike was actually a JR 50, a little Suzuki, and my sister and I shared it. And then, you know, I didn't want to get off the thing, I guess. So then I went to a Italojet 50. I don't know if you ever heard of a Italojet.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. It was a little blue one. And I started racing a little bit probably around the age of six. And at Indian Dunes is where I first raced. Then we would go and they would have racing every weekend, pretty much, either Friday night race or Saturday night, you know, you race under the lights. And I don't know. I don't recall, you know, those early years too much. Basically, I remember one time my throttle got stuck wide open, and I was heading, it was in the like the pit area, and I was heading for a chain link fence, and I was getting ready to crash into the fence, and I guess I had the instincts to, low side it, to just, like slide out, and the throttle was wide open. And so my dad was like, ah, he thought that was impressive, I guess. But yeah, we just started, going and doing it for fun. And then we would do a little series of races in a row. Then if you're the overall champion, you might get a free set of tires or a can of chain lube or whatever. And the other thing about me, you probably know, but I'm a little bit of an introvert. So I think I love being able to put on a helmet and no one can actually see me, who I am, and just get in my own little world or zone and just ride. And I never really talked about it a whole lot. It was all about, I would rather put my helmet on and go out and go win or do really well. And I don't know, be noticed, that way instead of just talking about it. So I think that helped just keep me really focused and just sticking to writing.
Cool. Oh yeah, I love the story, man. I always love these stories. That's my favorite thing. But yeah, I really like the bit, about you talking about being an introverted kid and that sort of thing. Is believe it or not, most people wouldn't believe it, but I was too. So, so people wouldn't believe it. That I mean, nowadays mostly, but yeah, that I certainly can resonate with that a little bit, man. Yeah, cool. Cool. So maybe just we might just move on to maybe your, I guess, when did your racing sort of start to get serious? When did you first sort of started to get into things and get a little serious and start to think, geez, I could maybe, actually be a pro and do something with this?
Probably in 1984, my first really big win was at the World Mini at Saddleback in the Pee-wee class, and I won. So, essentially I was like, Pee-wee national champion at 8 years old. And from that point, I felt like I always had a little bit of help with sponsors and, maybe getting, some free riding gear and a little discount on motorcycles or whatever that my dad had to pay for. But and from that point, I just kind of carried on, and every year we would go to the big amateur races, and I was always at the very top of my class, either winning or top three. Then it just slowly started to build where, soon I was getting, like two free motorcycles and a little parts allowance and, five sets of free riding gear and a free helmet or whatever. But we just kind of stuck to the big amateur races. And I was either winning or, in that top three. So it wasn't until, I don't know, probably later when I was on 80cc bikes, where kind of 80 intermediate and 80 expert, where I really started to, I was watching, Rick Johnson and Johnny O'Mara and David Bailey, and like those guys were, all my heroes, and Ron Lachine. I really started to following the Supercross and the pro racing, but it wasn't until I was probably around like 13, 14 that, thinking, okay, one day I could be there. Well, I had a little deal through Team Green Kawasaki, and even when I was on 60s, kind of around, I guess that would be, 85, 80, 86, where I don't know if the bikes were fully free, one or two free bikes, but definitely a discount to where at least my dad could sell the bikes at the end of the year and kind of make our money back. And then I went from Kawasaki to Suzuki, R&D Suzuki in 88 and 89. And I know for sure at that point I was getting some free motorcycles, maybe three or four. And then and some free gear, a lot, really helping out my dad a lot because he was the one driving me and paying for gas and taking me all over the country.
That
And
R&D
then
Suzuki team, those R&D Suzuki,
yeah.
those bikes, they were good, man. Like, there's a lot of people came up on those bikes, didn't they? They were awesome. They were probably nearly the pinnacle, I guess, of mini bike teams, weren't they? R&D Suzuki.
I think starting with, Mike Healy and Buddy Antonez and Jimmy Gaddis. Buddy was, he was the man on an 80, super fast. But and then I used to, the amateur races, you would get like the big East Coast guys like Brian Swink and there were so many guys that were just slightly ahead of me, but I really looked up to them and watched them. I was always a very visual learner, so I loved watching, the pro class or the 80 expert class and just, hearing the bikes and just seeing how they're working the clutch and carrying the speed. That's how I learned, just watching.
Cool, man. Who was your in those days, did you have a like an on-track rival, that kid that was always you're always battling with this certain one kid that tends to happen a lot of the time?
For sure. I would say my first run-in where I went head to head was Ezra Lusk. Ezra. So even at the 1984 World Mini, they came all the way from Georgia to California. And I won. I don't know what class I won. I won one of them, but I beat him, head to head, and so all the way through, 60s and 80s, he was kind of always the guy to beat. Him and Jeff DeMint, I battled a lot with DeMint, and then Craig Decker, quite a bit, David Pingree. Those are kind of like the main guys. And then Ezra turned pro. He pretty much went from 80 expert to 125 pro. And I did a whole year of 125 intermediate, like the B class. But Ezra went, I mean, he just jumped right into the pro class. He probably was a little faster than me at that point. And Suzuki, put him right out there in the factory team in 92.
Cool. So your first I've got it written down here, man. Your first pro race was that Houston 92 East West Shootout. That's what the vault says. The vault's not always
I
right,
think
but it usually
so.
is.
I think you're right. I forgot it was an East West. That's crazy that the first race for the West Coast would have been an East West combined race. I forgot about that.
So that's
I
you did.
know I qualified, right? I don't know what I got. 12?
Yeah, I didn't write down your result, but I think you
Oh.
must have you've got you've you, yeah, because the vault, I think the vault only shows main events, so you must have
Oh,
qualified.
okay.
I think if you missed it, the vault doesn't even there's no record of it. So
I don't think I've never not qualified for a 125 Supercross. So I know that for sure.
Cool. And then so your first win, Anaheim 93. Anaheim was very good for you, man. Like it was a
Three in a row there.
happy hunting ground there, man. Yeah, 93, 94, 95. Anaheim,
Yeah.
it was
Well,
definitely.
and 96. I got second behind Jeremy in the 250 class. So
yeah.
Four really good years. Actually, in 92, I was running third place. It was Jeremy. He was on the peak Honda.
Yep.
Then Buddy Antonez on the peak Honda. And I was running third. And then my bike seized or, you know, blew up on me.
Yeah.
So I was running third, a pretty solid third for about half the race. And then my bike just went, whoa, and just done. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're right. Yeah. Anaheim, 93 Anaheim was totally awesome. I'm only 17 years old and I was still going to regular high school, just regular, you know, just a senior in high school. Then I was so quiet and shy that people at my own high school really, they didn't even really know at like what level I rode and raced at, because I didn't talk about it. You know, I went to school, did my work, went home, and I was out riding. But when I won in 93, then I came back to school Monday morning, kind of like no big deal. Then there's a lot of kids from the school and even some teachers that happened to be there. So I became a little bit of a celebrity at that point. Yeah.
Yeah. That, how did that feel as an introverted kid? Was that just like, oh, I wish they didn't know, or did you actually enjoy it?
I think inside I loved it. You know, I secretly, I was never like a cool kid. I was always quiet and did my own thing. It was like I had friends at school, and that's the only time I saw them. I never hung out with them after school. I never went to parties, never went to the prom. It was purely school. Then as soon as I was out of school, it was, you know, I was doing, you know, lap times on the track.
Yeah.
And but it was cool. It really, you know, it was really neat at that time.
Yeah. As a young person, it must have given you just a huge boost of confidence, at least inside.
Yeah. You know, I think I've always been, I quietly want to just destroy you, and hated losing. No matter what it is, I always want to win.
Yeah.
But also, you know, my dad pushed me so hard that I had to win or else I'm going to hear it from him all the way home, you know? So that gave me extra motivation too. He knew how to kind of push my buttons and fire me up, and or else I was going to hear it. But inside, you know, obviously I had that drive and passion and, you know, didn't like to lose, you know, just same as all the top guys. You know, Carmichael always talked about how he just hated losing, had like a fear of losing.
Yep.
And I guess when you do so much winning your whole life that, you know, getting fifth or seventh or whatever, that sucks.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool, man. We move into your championship years the next up, man. So yeah, just memories from your championship years. Maybe, you know, was there a specific race or time in 94 where you really sort of, it started to feel real, like I've got this championship. Like if I keep it together, I'm going to win this thing.
Yeah, it really started back in 93. Because in 93, I won four of them, but I didn't win the championship. Jimmy Gaddis, he was on the podium every race. He never won, but he was top three every time.
Yeah.
And I won four, and I was just all over the place. So for me, the way it worked out, you know, 92 was a learning year. I had a couple moments that were pretty good. 93, I broke out and won a lot. 94, I only won two of them, but I was top three every time. So I kind of got that consistency. Then 95, it all just came together, and I won, the first six in a row. And I got second in the other two. It was just building and learning and confidence. 95, yeah, it was a feeling of, I got the number one plate. I'm the man. I'm gonna win. I got the best bike. I got the best mechanic. I'm just young and dialed in and confident and right in my prime. So that's so really, going back in 93, I was really up and down. Then I got on a podium, I want to say in Dallas, which was at East West. And then I won the last three in a row, San Jose, the Rose Bowl, and Vegas. And then 94, I was on the podium every race. Then 95, I was on the podium every race. So that's 20 Supercrosses in a row that I was top three. So that's I don't know if that's a record for the 125 class or not, but I'm not really sure.
I'm gonna look it up. I'm gonna look it
Look it
up and
up.
I'll look it
Yeah.
up and I'll let you know for sure.
So yeah, I
Yeah,
had four in a row at the end of
that's
93. Then I don't know how many rounds there were. Eight. There was eight in 95. So four, eight, and eight is 20. Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
So it's a good run.
You mentioned your mechanic there. So
Yep.
through all that time, it was Tony.
Yep.
Yeah, Tony
Not
Baluti.
in
Yeah.
93. I
Oh,
had
okay.
this guy, Mark Johnson, Caveman, they called him. And he was great. It was Suzuki making some changes, and Tony became available, and they thought it would be a better match for me. And it ended up being the perfect match because he knew how to be really positive and boost me up, but also get me a little fired up and motivated. I mean, he worked really well with me. It worked well. Yeah.
That the mechanic rider relationship is really interesting. I don't think people outside of the sport couldn't possibly imagine how important that relationship is. Like, yeah, they've got to be a good mechanic as far as
Yeah.
working on the bike, but that relationship with the rider and they're not just a mechanic, especially back in the day, they're a motivational speaker.
Yeah.
They're a dad to some kids. It's huge, that huge sort of the people skills is probably was just as or maybe more important than their actual skills with a spanner.
You're absolutely right. And I think it was probably even a little more crucial because we were in box vans. And occasionally I would travel with them inside the box van. Like during the summer for nationals, we would stay back east for a little bit. But I was talking about this the other day with some guys, and my 125 days, like having a good mechanic. No matter if you're on a factory team or privateer, your mechanic was still required to kind of do that little bit of fine tuning, with the jetting and the air screw and just all, those little tiny tricks of just, making that throttle nice and buttery feeling and, it was probably more crucial back then. And, now it seems like the guys have a mechanic to keep the nuts and bolts tight, but then there's an engine guy, there's a suspension guy, there's a, chassis guy or electronics guy. But back in the day, it was your mechanic, building your engine, tearing it down, putting new piston rings in it, whatever it was, and building that bike with that little bit of extra love or knowledge, So it was a combination of the Suzuki 125 was a good bike those years. I had hands down the best mechanic, and I was just right in my prime.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. I love it. And then into 250s, man. And what a year to have to go into 250s when like the greatest ever's on his greatest season like
Yeah.
that your time that timing was no good. But yeah, it, you went was Anaheim the first round that year? Or no, it would have been the second round that year, probably, was it?
No, it started in Orlando,
Yeah.
and I believe I finished fourth.
Yep.
It was good. I didn't even know. I came by that race on somewhere YouTube, and I won my heat race, which I didn't remember winning a heat race back then, but I won the heat, then got fourth in the main. Then maybe round two was Anaheim. I'm not really sure.
Yeah. I think back then, yeah, I think it was in those years because it was real weird. It was like
Yeah, all
you're
the
going
trucks had to go
all
all the
the
way to
way east, and then
Orlando
yeah, I look back
and
at
then
some of
come all
these
the way
things, and
back.
it's strange, but I guess it was just the availability of the stadiums at the time,
Yeah,
or I don't know, but
yeah.
yeah. But then yeah, second to MC at 96 Anaheim, and you know, which when you look at it, that's just about a win, isn't it? So yeah.
It's pretty big. I mean,
Yeah.
nowadays, to get second is huge. But coming in as my rookie year in 96, I wanted to win and I believed that I could win. And I think a lot of guys who have been racing with Jeremy since, well, 93, I guess his first year on 250s, they were kind of used to getting beat. And
Yep.
I was new. I loved that Kawasaki was a great bike. I tried desperately to try to get Berluti to follow me to Cowie, and he just couldn't do it. Kawasaki required him to live in California and be at the race shop during the week, and his whole family was in Vegas, and he had quite a bit of seniority at Suzuki, and but anyways, it started off really good. And again, I felt great on the bike. Physically, I felt great. Then I suffered from some bad starts in a lot of those races and worked my way up and, was passing all those guys except for Jeremy. But I was getting close, really close to getting them that year. Yeah.
Yeah, obviously I'm a historian of the sport, and yeah, you watch races and look at results. Now, like, you're probably, I don't think you weren't second in points in the end, were you? But you were kind of
No.
looking back, looking at just watching things and looking at it. You were the second best guy, basically,
Well,
in
yeah,
my
I ran
opinion, that year.
second. I had four second place finishes behind Jeremy. That great race at Seattle, where actually I passed him and he would pass me back and I would get him through the hoops again, and my clutch just faded out. I had so much free play that even with it all the way in, my bike was still just going around corners, and I stalled it. Then the very next week, my bike, they manufactured an adjustable clutch that would tighten up the cable. So I might have been like the first guy with one of those on my bike. But first one at Cowie. So after Seattle, like I knew it. I knew I could beat him. And I got third at Daytona, decent ride, and then I think another second maybe at Houston or somewhere. And then during the week practicing, I had this endo where I nosed into another jump, and I sprained or jammed my wrist really bad to where, I couldn't really move it without having pain. So then I ended up riding Tampa with a wrist brace that was really made from as a rollerblading wrist guard
All right,
piece of
yeah.
plastic. Yeah, that, I had my arm in, and this one on off section, I had my bike jumped into neutral. So when I jumped on and I went to accelerate going off, I just went straight over the handlebars, and I ended up tearing my ACL, and then the season was done.
Yeah.
But up until that point, yeah, I was second in points with a pretty good gap over third, and Jeremy was winning every week, but I had a pretty strong second going for a while. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That ACL tear is a bit of a and sort of, from a fan's point of view, it derailed a lot of momentum your career had. Would you say that's right?
Yeah, it was really like the first time getting injured for me, and going through a rehabilitation process and having surgery, first time having surgery. So it was tough. Then you're riding and it's a little hard to stick your leg out, or you're afraid to dab it here and there. But really, it was kind of the beginning of the end of my career, because I had 3 years in a row of having surgery and breaking bones. And 96, I did my knee. I always came back and I won and did well. So I came back in 97, I won Atlanta Supercross. The off season, I won the World Supercross series, which that counts as an actual FIM World Championship.
That was that.
Yeah.
Well, that year, was that where it was mostly, it was Canada? They did a few in Canada, or did they go elsewhere that year?
It was still a full on world championship. Osaka,
Okay.
Tokyo. All 3 nights in Paris counted, 2 nights in Barcelona, and 2 nights in Geneva, Switzerland.
Yeah.
It was an actual championship, with, I don't know how many rounds that is, like 9 rounds, maybe more, 10. All the big names were in it,
Yeah.
including Jeremy and Pashon. And I think some of the guys didn't go to Japan. It was mainly the factory guys that went to Japan, but all the other rounds, the typical, Larry Ward and Mike Craig, and LaRocco at some of them, and I don't know who else. But that was 97. But it was cool to come out on top on that one, and
Absolutely.
actually count it as a world championship.
It is a world championship, man. Yeah,
Yeah.
absolutely. Yeah.
But and then I broke my lower leg. I broke my lower leg after winning Atlanta. Then I was in a cast, my whole leg in a cast for, 6 weeks. Then it took a little bit to get back, but I came back, and I won Troy, Ohio, the outdoor national, where, I don't know if you remember that one, but I beat Carmichael both motos in the 125 class. That's kind of a big highlight in my career.
Because there's not
And
many,
then
not many people have done that.
no, I think there's really like four, maybe five guys in the world that have actually beat Carmichael straight up both motos in a national. Robbie Raynard, Kevin Windham, Bubba, and maybe me. Maybe there's only four. Yeah.
Very short
But
list.
yeah, small list. So I came back strong. Yeah, I won that. I won the world championship Supercross. Then in 98, 98, we got off track with the bike. We did a ton of off-season testing. We were trying all kinds of different things on the bike. We had this electronic rear shock where the shock was wired. It had like a little, brain in it where it was wired to the ignition. And when the bike would reach a certain RPM, the shock would like stiffen up. And we're trying to make it start better. When you're wide open going down the start, the rear shock would get really stiff and wouldn't squat and or wheelie. Now this is all before the little starting device where you click the front end down, which I think they need to take those off. They need to go back to
Totally.
dirt, no starting device,
Nothing.
come
All on the
on.
skill. I reckon too. I like that.
And there's so many first turn pileups now because everyone is
Everyone's good.
launching perfect. They're coming into that first turn, seven wide, and there's no room. Or, you got people cutting over. But dirt, no starting device, there's going to be some separation.
Absolutely.
Anyways, getting off track.
No, that's all. I'm on
I
board
have
with
so many
that.
ideas that can make Supercross so much better, because now I'm just a fan. I've been a fan for so many years, just watching it on TV, and they can do so much more. If you want to get into that, we can, or talk about it later, but
Hey, we might. That's
jeez, man.
next time you're on, I'm gonna pencil that in. Next time you're on, we're gonna get into that because I don't want to take up too much of your time today, and I want to talk a bit more about your career and that, of course. But I'd love to get into that sort of stuff for sure. On when we do Huff Daddy show two, huh? That'd be great
All
one
right.
day. Dude, that's really interesting what you're saying about that 98 KX, because the 97 and 98 bikes were, to someone like me, they're pretty similar bikes. It wasn't an upgrade in that, but the there were struggles. The 97 bike was, obviously very good. Obviously, throw one on it, both series, and then
Kind of. Well,
okay,
I'll stop you there.
okay,
So, IMIG, all through 97, just rode the 96 setup that he won the outdoor nationals on. And he straight up would show up to testing. He would show up late, leave early, and be like, "Now, you know what? I'm just going to stick to I like my original setup." Then we had, Rhino and myself are out there just beating in laps. I'm thinking every year the bike should get better, but think of Jeremy, 93, 94, 95, 96 was basically the same bike. Pretty close to the same bike all
Especially
those years.
his bike, because the story is he kept using the 93 frame.
So IMIG, he rode the 96 bike all through 97 and he won everything. I didn't like my 97 as much as my 96, and I really hated the 98 way more than the 97 and 96. We finally started going back to just our old settings in 98, and even Jeff got he was doing bad, and I got a third, I think, at New Orleans. Felt good to be back on the podium. And then like the following week is when I broke my femur in Michigan. And then that was it.
And then that 99 KX, the update was famously not a great bike. So, well, I don't know. It's interesting your opinion, because Ricky and Fro hated that 99. So,
It felt different. At that time, I had an offer to go to, I think Suzuki, and I think I was talking to Yamaha about riding the 400
Oh
that
yeah,
they had at the time.
yep.
So that's kind of I wonder what would have happened there, because that thing would have been a huge advantage.
Yes.
But it was just so different that I didn't have the confidence to be like, oh yeah, I'm going to be the only guy on this bike and I'm going to win on it. So I stuck with Cowie. I took a pay cut, stuck with Cowie, teammates with Carmichael. And it was just an okay year. You know, honestly, after having 3 years of broken bones and surgeries, I had a goal. One of my goals was to make it through every race and to be like injury free. So kind of naturally, that's kind of a good thought, but you know, looking back on it now, that really takes you from a guy who can maybe win or get on the podium to now you're a top five guy, top five, top seven, with that kind of mentality of thinking, I don't want to get hurt. So no regrets because, hey, I'm still pretty healthy and I never did anything too gnarly to my body. But, and I had a long career and that's why just having it's that little intangible something that the top guys just have over the rest to where the other guys are look like they're just struggling a hair. And the top guys are just hanging it out.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, man. Like,
Yeah.
you know, anyone that's a fan of the sport would, yeah, you can, as I'm listening to you, there's riders running through my head, even riders out there right now. Malcolm Stewart, right now,
Yeah.
wants to get through the season. You know, he's got the speed to win a
Probably.
race. Yeah, that
Yeah.
sort of thing. There's people every year, there's guys like that where, you know, they're coming off injury and there's something where they're just not at that same level and that sort of thing, and partly
Yeah,
physical
it's tough.
sometimes, but that mental side, yeah.
I guess, you know, an analogy would be, you know, if you're not that I'm for this, but if you're gonna, you know, beat your dog, your dog isn't gonna do that anymore. He's gonna be a little gun shy, like, oh shit, I don't wanna do that. But and that's, you know, hitting the ground, snapping bones and having surgeries, it's like, yeah, I don't want to do that anymore. You know, you can't really blame myself, but and I listen to these guys, you know, like Rhino and Trey Canard, and they talk about all their injuries, and I'm just like, holy cow, that's crazy. You know, still I've only broken five bones in my whole life, you know, knock on wood, but and you know, two of them are fingers. And a collarbone and you
You've
know, a
done well
couple big
then.
bones, but
You've done well. You think about it, you've done pretty
you know,
well
they're
there.
talking about, oh, I broke my back three times and my neck once and broke femurs, and I'm just, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy stuff, but
It is a crazy
yeah.
sport, isn't it? You know, like it's when you would have come across times in your life where somebody who's not a moto person comes to an event and gets talking to moto people and the subject of injuries come up, it just blows them away, doesn't it? Like, they think you're making things up. They think you're lying sometimes. Like, is that no, that's, you didn't really do that. They think you're
Well,
telling tales.
it's such a crazy sport because you can still kind of race with the, you know, guys have done it, you know, either a broken hand or thumb or, you know, badly sprained ankle or a torn up no ACL. There's not too many other sports where you can still compete and still win. You know, I remember Pastrana raced with a broken hand. He rode it with a cast on his hand all summer and still won the championship. You know, where you know, if you re relate it to like golf, you can have a fingernail that's like bothering you and it's gonna like affect your swing, or if your feet or ankles are messed up, forget about it. Or a bad back, but motocross, I don't know, you know, it's the bike underneath you and all the gear. And I think just adrenaline
Adrenaline,
pumping through your body that I broke my collarbone last week. I got a plate on it, but I'm still racing, right? It's like, yeah, other sports, you're not doing that, but that's crazy.
It is, man. It is. So after that, man, you went back to Suzuki and you had also a little stint on a Yamaha and then to Honda. So you got right across the brands later in your career.
So back to Suzuki, just a 1 year deal. It was a pretty good year. And that was really the last year on a factory team in 2000. I had one podium. I had a number of good races where I was consistent, but those like top four guys were just a little separated it was a fun year. I didn't really do that great outdoors, consistent, top five, top 10. And then 2001, I don't even remember that well. It was one of my worst years. I went to a privateer Moto World
Moto
Yamaha
World.
team, and I didn't like the bike. Not a whole lot stands out other than I rode the 250F outdoors, and I think I had a couple podiums on that. And that was fun. Supercross, not fun, but outdoors, because there's still a lot of 125s out there. Well, only Yamaha had the four stroke, but I love that little bike.
And that
It
was
was so easy to ride.
before we realized what an advantage that was. It was still like, oh, are these things better than a 125? We're not sure yet,
They're hard to start. You don't want to stall them. They're tricky, but I love that little bike. It was so easy to ride, and it just had a little bit more power than a 125. And yeah, I know I had a couple podiums, maybe two or three podiums on it outdoors. So that was cool. Then that I stuck with the same team, and they went to Suzuki's in 2002, and then I was back on, two strokes, and again, not a great year, really.
And then the Moto Triple X after that.
So really, I started in 03 with nothing at all. Nothing. I had a couple deals lined up that didn't work out, and then I went to the first race, like literally in my pickup truck, with a bike that Honda gave me, and I didn't qualify. I felt really weird doing it that way. And then Moto Triple X, I don't know if Kyle Lewis or someone was hurt at the time, but they're like, hey, come ride our bike. And then it started to pick up. And that summer, I already had a deal to go to Canada with Blackfoot Honda. And that was a lot of fun. And then in 2004, Moto Triple X again. And I had a really good year. I had a couple top fives. I got fourth at Anaheim. It was like Anaheim three or whatever it was, but fourth place is pretty solid on a full almost stock with bolt-on parts, four stroke. That was really cool. I had a lot of hole shots that year. I think a hole shot at like four or five races. But then back to Canada, and I just kind of kept that up all the way through 05. Then 05, 2005 was my last year doing Supercross.
Yeah, cool, man. And then lots of things after that, man.
Kind of,
The 6 days you did how many years did you do the 6 days? Just the 1 year?
just 1 year, 2009, and that was one of the last events I ever did. So 2006, I didn't race or really ride at all, nothing at all. My first boy was born in 05, my second one was born in 06, And I was just kind of like, what am I doing with my life? And then I started to write a little bit. I was doing writing lessons and kind of felt like I wasn't quite done. I was done with Supercross. It's just a brutal schedule. It's so hard to not be injured. I was burnt out on the travel, but I did all three of the Enduro cross races at the end of 07. And I jumped right in and got third. My next one, I got second. And then Kawasaki was like, what are your plans? You want to race off-road? And I was like, yeah, I'll do off-road. So I got picked up by Cowie in 08 and 09, doing the works races and Enduro Cross. Pretty much second overall every year I did an Enduro Cross. Maybe third the last year, but almost won the title in 08.
Who won the title?
Ricky Dietrich.
Okay,
You know that name? So I won, it was only six races and I won three of them. And one race I broke my finger here. Finger was sideways and I didn't qualify that night. I didn't get it fixed because there was like a week off and then Vegas Enduro Cross the final. And I went out and I won it. I won the final and lost it by a couple points. Yeah, that was a bummer.
And you did some works races as well for that time.
Yeah, 08 and 09, and those are gnarly. They're very GNC. I did one GNCC race and one and all the works races, and the gnarliest races I've ever done, even gnarlier than Southwick, Unadilla, all that. You can add up your whole time of riding on at a national, both practices and both motos, and it still doesn't even add up to the amount of time like one race is. 2 hours plus a lap, which sometimes one lap would be over 20 minutes long. Through the gnarliest off-road terrain, plus motocross, plus like pro sections with enduro cross logs and tires and mud. I mean, it felt like everyone was like doing a marathon. For me, I was a little bit older, but the schedule was great because I would have 2 or 3 weeks to recover before the next one. So I loved it. I would have gone on another year or two, but Kawasaki just ended. I think they ended their off-road program because of the economy and to pay Villopoto money because he was winning, every Supercross title. Yeah.
Cool,
So that
man.
was it.
Cool.
But ISDE was insane. That was tough. Yeah.
I'd
One
love
and done.
to
But
love to when I get you back on next time, we're going to dig more into your off-road racing career, I reckon. So
yeah.
that was and nowadays you've got a I've seen on Instagram you're jumping on a Suzuki again. You've got a you got an RMZ.
I do from Suzuki. Finally, it's taken a little while. They've had, believe it or not, they're like short on bikes, and but I have a brand new one. And I'm working on, I just got the just the other day from Throttle Syndicate. I don't want to talk too much about it, but it's going to be kind of like my one of my old replica race bikes that Berluti used to build. It's
Nice.
going to have that old retro, I think 1995 look to it. So I'm slowly starting to piece that together, and this summertime I'll put out a little more content, maybe some YouTube videos or Instagram, just little stuff here and there.
Cool.
But I got, the guys at Fast House, setting me up with all the gear, all the mountain bike gear and gear for my boys to ride in, and X brand goggles, and yeah, it's cool to have, that little bit of support and love, and so I can ride, a little bit and have some fun.
Cool, man. Cool. Hey, time for a quick ad read, Damon. Yeah, I'm proud to say that Guts Racing is a sponsor of the Outside Gate. So when RJ Hampshire, when RJ he when RJ lit the flames in Nashville, he was on a Guts seat. So how about that?
Okay.
And if you buy a new Husky Rockstar Edition, FC250 or FC450, they come off the showroom with a Guts seat on them. So that's pretty cool to have a have an OEM on their premium bike actually delivering it with a Guts seat on it. So if it's good enough for them, it's good enough for anybody, including HEP Suzuki, Moto Concepts Honda, Phoenix Honda, AEO KTM, PRMX Kawasaki, and countless privateers. Even my old ass sits on a Guts seat. And as Scott Meshey says, a privateer hero, Scott Meshey, as he says, they're a butt gripper and they will make you a ripper. So if you want to check out gutsracing.com, that's a real easy one to remember, gutsracing.com. Check them out and get yourself a seat like Scott Meshey and like RJ Hampshire. Awesome. You have to get a gut seat on that Suzuki, or you might have another seat sponsor, which is okay too.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, I don't know yet. But I tell you what, as I get older, I really don't like the stock seats. I think I'm a tall guy. I'm 6'1", and I feel like the brand new modern day bikes are getting a little too narrow.
They are, aren't they?
And I remember my 90, back in the 90s, those bikes are a little wider. They had bigger, thicker seats. And I used my knees a lot and, would grip the seat. And now the seats are so thin and narrow that I feel like my knees are like pinching together.
Hey,
So,
this is
yeah.
perfect, Damon, because Guts actually makes a seat called the wide wing seat. So it's
Yeah, I'm there.
a foam and a
Yeah.
cover that is actually wider at the knees to grip the bike better.
Yeah.
That's actually a thing. So there you go. If you get on
I
there and
know.
tell just make sure you tell Andy Gregg that you heard it from me. Hey? So
Yeah, there you go.
he'll know that I'm doing the job for him for his sponsorship. Yeah.
Yeah.
Fantastic, man. But yeah, that is a product they make for that exact reason. So
Yeah, I'll be looking. I would love to get someone of a custom seat that's slightly taller and just a little bit wider. I mean, the seats nowadays are only a few inches wide, and that's hard on the butt.
It
Yeah.
is hard. It is hard.
I
That's
need,
right.
those old seats had, they're pretty wide. It was nice to seat bounce or go through corners, and now I'm telling you, riding it is just a ride. A track is like painful feeling. I feel it all through my back, but yeah.
Cool, man. Just a couple of things. We didn't want to keep you too much more than an hour, and we're getting close to that, but I just wanted to
Okay.
just touch on a couple of things of what you get up to nowadays. We've spoken about your mountain biking. Obviously, yeah, you've got kids that are into mountain biking as well, and you are your day job is it or is it still working for LA's Finest?
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. I'm still a motor cop for LAPD. So, just over 13 years now doing that. About half the time has been on the bike now. Just over 6 years on the bike, but I'm actually getting ready next week, well, May 7th, I'm going to be flying back to New York City for, it's called the Police Week or the Unity Tour. It's part of the whole Police Memorial Foundation where to raise money and to like awareness for how many officers that are actually killed in the line of duty every year. So I'll be able to ride my actual LAPD BMW in New York City and through Washington, D.C. We're going to be back there for like 5 days. I've never done that before. It's my first time. But yeah, whatever to get me off the regular streets of L.A. It's still pretty crazy. We just really kind of do what we can and try to stay safe. And that's about it. But until they start enforcing laws, because we're so held back by our policies, it could be a state law, but LAPD's policy is like, oh no, go ahead, jaywalk and drive around with your blacked out windows, and it's they don't want us really doing much enforcement. So everyone just gets a little more disrespectful, I guess, because they can get away with it. But yeah, it's okay. I don't love what I do. There's a bunch of guys I work with that are good guys, and I enjoy my time with them. But the actual job, it's not me. I work with a bunch of good guys, but we're kind of on the same page. Like,
The job's got harder over your time. Has the job got harder, or was it just sort of much the same?
yes and no. Harder where if we actually do any enforcement, they're always making some sort of, bringing race into it, or you stop me because of this, or I'm this color. But that part's gotten tougher, but our job's gotten easier because we don't have to do that enforcement like we used to. We just mainly go to traffic collisions and deal with traffic reports and drunk drivers occasionally, but the traffic accidents can be really, really bad too. But for the most part, it's going to a handful of accidents, making sure either they're getting a report done or they got their exchange of information and they can be on their way, just helping get tow trucks there and clean up the street and get traffic moving. But I don't know. I can really talk bad about it, but I'm not. It's just it is what it is. Yeah.
That's
I'm
okay.
happy to be employed and have great benefits and a paycheck that comes every 2 weeks, and we do a lot of good stuff sometimes, but we do get a lot of middle fingers saying we're number one and we're not really well liked, which all we do is go around helping people for the most part. But I'm just trying to get to the 20-year mark and get out. That's my
Yeah,
plan.
fair enough.
Yeah.
You guys, you obviously grew up in California, and now you do it as a job. You probably don't realize how, or you might have been told just how cool the cars and the bikes are to people that aren't from California. So I went to my first overseas trip was this January, and it was
Yeah.
to California to go to Anaheim One. And growing up, we see constantly TV movies of California, and
Yeah.
LA black and white cop car went the first one I
Huh.
saw when I was there. That was so cool. It was like, wow, that is just, and every time I saw one, I was just like, that is just so cool, because it's just
Yeah.
like reminds me of every cool movie I've ever
A
seen.
lot of
And I
movies.
saw motorbike cops as well. I was just like, that is
Yeah,
cool.
yeah.
Yeah, it's so, and I
Yeah,
know
and
I remember being told, years ago that you're not allowed to take photos of the police. But I was like, oh, I nearly wanted to ask someone, say, hey, can I just take a photo of your car? Because this is so cool.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it was a cool thing. But I thought, oh, I better not. Yeah, I better not bother them. So, but yeah, it is a really cool thing. I remember our cop cars are, they're blue and white here in Victoria. Okay. And and they used to have these real big round lights on them. And then at one stage in the would have been in the 90s, they changed to the big light bars, like the LA cop cars have. And I remember us just thinking that was cool, that the local, like, you know, the highway patrol cars here, they got these, you know, we started calling them LA styles because they had the LA style lights. And it was, it was a bit of a thing that people, you guys would be used to seeing them every day when you're out in traffic.
Yeah.
For me, that was actually something that I didn't expect to sort of see and think was so cool. Yeah. Well, that was for sure, man.
Yep. Black and white. Yeah.
That's it. Just a couple of quick things. What other skills do you have or would you love to have?
I think naturally I'm probably just kind of best on two wheels. I've been playing golf for over 30 years now, and sometimes I feel like I should be better than I am, and other times I feel like, you know, I'm pretty good. I'm better than most, but that's a game that will just drive you crazy for your whole entire life. Good question. I mean, I love golf. It's a passion of mine. I would love to be, you know, like on the PGA tour or something, but that's never going to happen.
Yeah. Actually, a lot of moto guys that I've asked that question, they would love to be great at golf. It's funny how many moto people are into golf because it's almost like that's, it's the polar opposite sport, and it gives them something that they don't get from moto, you know, I guess. Yeah, it's like it's a funny thing, that connection there.
Yeah, my love is, I love, you know, especially being on a nice, pretty golf course and being outdoors. But also, you know, you step up, you have one shot, just one, you know, opportunity to make a good swing and execute the shot you want. And, you know, you might blow it. Then if you drop a ball, then, you know, second time, oh, there it is, I can do it. So it's so competitive with like just your inner self, but at the same time being really relaxing and being outdoors and it's peaceful, or, you know, almost, I mean, I feel like I've had like spiritual moments on the golf course with, you know, the little light fog burning off and the sunlight and the dew on the grass. I mean, it's, you can really get into it, but that's why I loved it, because it's still so challenging and mentally tough, yet you're not wearing yourself out, or you're not going to go over the bars and get injured doing it. But I don't know. I think I wish I was smarter with like investing my money, or, you know, I probably want to be an actual cop right now, but, you know, I have no regrets. You know, I had such an awesome time racing professionally for 17 years, you know, traveling the world and, you know, getting paid to do it. And, it was awesome. It's a bummer you can't do it as long as you can like golf, but
right.
I just enjoy, I enjoy my days off with the kids. We have three kids, 18, 17 and 13, two boys and a girl. And, I just got back mountain biking with the boys. I'm like looking pretty red in my point of view on the camera,
Okay, yeah.
but
Bit of
I got a little
vitamin D.
sun.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, spending time with the kids, or our oldest kid is getting ready to go to aviation school in Arizona.
Yep.
So it's kind of, he's going to be leaving later this summer, which, I'm really stoked for him, and I want him to grow and continue to learn. But like inside, it's like, man, he's like my riding buddy.
Yeah.
Or I take him golfing or to the range, and I have a couple dirt bikes for them to ride. But yeah, they're growing up, man, just getting
Yeah.
older.
Yeah, you can't stop that. I know my
Nope.
kids, yeah. I look at my kids sometimes and I can't believe they were little not long ago, and it just
Yeah.
it goes through that age, yeah. I've got a lot of younger friends who've got, young age kids, and I tell them to really savor that because, gee, it
Yeah.
goes quick. One
They,
minute
yep.
there, this funny little 6-year-old doing crazy stuff and asking you a million questions, and the next minute that 6-year-old 16 and they don't have time to talk to you. So
Yeah.
it goes super quick. Yeah.
Yeah. We've been lucky. All of our kids are they're we're still really tight with them, even our 18-year-old. But yeah, you get basically about 18 summers, 18 years, and then
Yes.
yeah, things change.
It's a
Yeah.
beautiful thing though, isn't it? It's a beautiful thing, that's for sure.
Yeah, he wants to be an airline pilot, some sort of commercial pilot. So
Yep.
we're gonna, do whatever we can to get him to achieve his goals, just like, my dad did for me when I was a kid. And but I would love to see him get to travel the world and just go to places. It could be an awesome career.
Absolutely, that's it. Yeah, sounds like an amazing career. So
Yeah, it can be, especially if you're flying international or
yeah.
even private jets. Who knows where it's going to lead, but that's the plan right now.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, I reckon it's I don't mind getting on all my planes to go somewhere cool. I don't reckon I'd have the confidence to try and fly one though, that's for sure.
Yeah, kind of crazy. He's been going through private lessons right now, but just in a little single engine airplane, and I've been up with them. Yeah, that's kind of the path, so pretty exciting.
It's amazing. Yeah, one of my best mate's daughters has just got her license to fly solo. And it's just like, and she's just like this quiet, polite sort of kid, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It's like, how are you so brave? Like, because
Oh,
she's
wow.
obviously, been doing lessons since she was pretty young. Because she's only 16, and she just got her
Oh,
license
wow.
to fly solo. So she's been doing lessons
Oh,
probably
wow.
as early as she was allowed to, and just like, wow,
Yeah.
like this, yeah, it's
Yeah,
cool.
Max, he hasn't soloed yet. He's taken off, but he's still with the flight instructor right now. So
Yeah.
getting there takes
Yeah,
time.
it does, yeah. What's your best bit of just life advice for young kids getting into moto?
I would say, like, if you want to race and you really want to see how far you can take it, well, number one, just go for it. Dedicate yourself. You're gonna have to give up other things, if you have other distractions, but for me, doing what I loved and getting to do it for a living for so long, looking back on it now, It was awesome. But I had a talk with like Kyle Chisholm and Freddie Norin, last year, and they're out there, they're doing decent. They qualify and still making a living at it. And I a lot of people would be like, time to give it up or whatever. But I told them, do it as long as you can. Do it as long as you can. Have fun. Try to enjoy it. And just until it's like really apparent, like, okay, you're not even qualifying anymore. You're not going to get the rides that you're getting currently, that sort of thing. But if you're still getting good rides and making money and making, I'm sure Chisholm is making well over six figures for the year, right? Keep on doing it, man. But like any sport, you have to be so focused and dedicated, and just it has to be what you think about in the morning and what you're thinking about as you're lying in bed. I had so many little tricks I did. Like, I never used the air conditioner in my car, like my whole racing career. It was like, I just want to adapt to the heat. Or I never, I it's almost like a phobia, but I never wanted any lotion, even like suntan lotion or oil, to get on my hands. I just wanted them to be like leather, right? Or else I'm going to get a blister. But it's little tiny sacrifices that I felt, help separate me from the next guy who's riding in my class. But you have to be willing to do that. And it's probably a little harder now with, cell phones and social media and everything going on now. But back in the day, it was, I had no distractions. If I wasn't riding, I was either riding my stand-up jet ski, I was mountain biking, I was playing tennis, golf. I was always just active, and I always try to focus and do things in the middle of the day when it's the hottest, with my cycling. I mean, I did things wrong. Like, I remember I'm going on 2 hour, I would practice all day, go on a 2 hour mountain bike ride, and I would think it'd be, I wouldn't take any water or anything with me, because you just got to grind it out and suffer. I'll hydrate when I get back. But when you're in a 30-minute moto plus two laps, you're not taking a sip of water. You really have to suffer and finish out those last couple laps, because and give it everything you have. And that's one thing Mike Kudrowski taught me. Kudrowski, I remember after one outdoor national, he's like, "How do you feel?" And I'm like, "Oh, yeah, I still feel pretty good." Thinking, yeah, I'm in good shape. Yeah, I'm not even tired. And he just like, no, that's the wrong mentality to have. He's like, you need to leave everything you have out on that track. And it's okay to be tired when you're done, but don't come back to the truck and be like, oh yeah, I can do another 30-minute moto. He was just like, no, just leave it all out there. Push through to the end. And that was really good advice. And you really have to, to run up front and to win, unless you're able to pull up a 30-second gap and cruise the last couple laps. But for the most part, yeah, you gotta, it's like a running race. You don't ease up at the finish line. You run through the finish, then you slow down, but if that's what it takes. So
Cool,
I don't
man.
know.
That's
That's about it. But
some good
working
advice,
hard,
man.
and
There's yeah.
yeah, that's what it ultimately boils down to. Yeah, there were times where I didn't want to practice or train, but mix it up. I did a lot of playwriting. I would playwright in the hills. I was always good about doing my motos and putting in the laps, but we would go to the desert. I did a lot of playwriting, but that's when I felt best and most comfortable on the bike. I think guys need to do that a little bit more rather than just,
Yeah.
lap times, lap times, lap times, lap times. I mean, go have fun.
I like it
Sometimes
fun. Yeah.
you get to the race and it's like you feel ready to race, But the other two things looking back on my career that I know would have helped me a lot. Number one, doing more stretching. And number two, warming up a lot more before the race, especially in Supercross. I would literally ride practice, then you wait until the night show. Then it's like, oh, I'm gonna do some jumping jacks and kind of, do a couple twists and like, all right, line up and go. Then if you had to ride like the semi race, back then we had a semi qualifier. Then if I rode the semi, honestly, the main event, I felt like zero arm pump, like it's on. If I qualified out of the heat, and then I had about hour and a half, 2 hour break, then the main event, I would always get a little arm pump. So I didn't mind going to the semi and getting that extra five laps. Then I was warmed up for the main. So I needed to warm up more before the motos. Yeah. And that's it.
Great advice, man. Great
Yeah.
advice. Dude, I do two things to close out the show. First one is give me your best Aussie accent.
Yeah, mate. Well, I was on the golf course today and no, I was talking about this with a buddy. I'm like, yeah, I'm doing this podcast with this Australian guy. And then he's like, oh, shrimp on the Barbie. Or I don't know. I've never been to Australia. I would love to go. Other than throwing in, yeah, mate, crikey, got a shrimp on the Barbie and give me one of those pastas. Yeah,
You're not too bad. You're not too
I don't
bad.
know.
Yeah, that's all.
You got the roos and the dingoes. You gotta watch out. I don't know, man.
Cool, man. Thanks for
That's all
that.
I
No,
got.
that's just a bit of fun I like to have.
Yeah.
Bit of fun I like to have. Yeah, sometimes you get you're somewhere in the middle. Sometimes you get ones that are just tragically bad, and then sometimes you get ones that are surprisingly good. So yeah.
Yeah,
But
I don't. Yeah, I know the Live Golf Tour is in Australia, so I'm looking forward to watching that on TV. But
I don't know heaps about golf, man, honestly. I know what LIV is. I know it's like it's a new tour. It's like a rival tour and that sort of thing, because I've you hear it on just sports radio stations and stuff a bit about it. But yeah, I don't know. I think Greg, is that Greg Norman's pretty involved in that? That's sort of his thing, is it?
He's behind that. I like it. It's something different. I like the announcers. I can stream it from my phone to the TV. There's no commercials. It's just shot after shot after shot after shot, and there's a little bit of a team element to it, So you have an individual winner and then you have a winning team, and it's kind of I think it's fun and different. So, and the one in Australia is in Adelaide.
I think I heard
It was
about it being in
insane.
Adelaide.
Yeah, the amount of fans and a guy made a hole in one, and the whole, I mean, there are so many beers being thrown, and it was absolutely insane. They went off.
Very good, man. All right, to close out the show, man, I sing a little bit of Kenny Rogers. There's a funny backstory to that, which I won't bore you with, but that's what I do. And I always say to people, if you know the words, you're welcome to join in. Most people don't, so don't worry. Don't worry about that. Most people don't. So I'll just ease into a bit of that. So I handed him my bottle, and he drank down my last swallow. Then he bummed a cigarette and asked me for a light. And the night got deathly quiet, and his face lost all expression. Said, if you're gonna play the game, boy, you gotta learn to play it right. You got to know when to hold them.
Yeah, I know that part.
Know when to walk away. Know when to run. You never count your money. When you're sitting at the table, there'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done. Damon Huffman, thank you very much. I'm going to call this part one because I definitely got lots more to talk to you about. And in the future, we'll get you on for a part two. That'd be fantastic. Okay. And yeah, thank you very much for your time. This has been a really fun pod. I don't say that to everyone. That's genuine. It's been really fun to talk to you. And yeah, you got a very interesting story. And yeah, good luck with your riding on your mountain bikes, your new Suzuki, and good luck to your family, your young fella with his aviation and all that sort of thing. It's been a pleasure.
Awesome. Well, I had a great time. Thank you for the invite on your show, and we'll do it again sometime. Sure.
Thank you, man. Cheers. Bye.
All right. Thank you.